From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman and hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 9, recorded February 27, 2006. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Automated QA, the makers of Test Complete, providing automated testing of Windows, .NET Framework, Java, and web applications, online at www.automatedqa.com. And by PeterBlum.com. Start with better controls, finish with better sites. Online at PeterBlum.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks about debugging by coincidence, debugging XML serializers, Ruby for .NET, Fusion, YAT, and other things too cool to mention here.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin, and you're listening to Hansel Minutes, show number 9. I'm here with Scott. Hi, Scott Hanselman.
Hello, Carl Franklin.
How are you? What are we going to talk about today?
Got a couple of random things, and then I want to talk about programming by coincidence and my buddy Patrick Caldwell's favorite subject, said with tongue firmly in cheek, debugging.
Ah, good.
By coincidence.
Excellent.
Yeah. But to start with, I got a couple of cool things to talk about. Two cool, one painful. First cool one is, you know how I plug into my Media Center PC using the Media Center feature of the Xbox 360?
I do.
Right, we remote, kind of remote desktop into it. But you're using a custom Xbox 360 kind of remote desktop.
Okay.
You know, parts of the user interface are remote desktop, parts aren't. And you can't browse the net. You can't run IE.
Right.
Right. But there's this fellow named Anthony Park at shrinkster.com/CI0.
He looks very young.
I think that's a picture of him last week before his beard came in. Yeah, he's a regular guy, although he's got a picture of himself at 10 on his blog.
Right.
And he's got a thing called MCE Browser. And basically, this is what you'd call a browser with a 10-foot interface. He's basically hosting IE with big buttons and the big MCE keyboard and allowing you to use your Media Center PC from far away and browse the net.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I especially like the telephone dial sort of keyboard interface there.
Right, because that mirrors the same interface that you might have on your remote control.
Right.
So he's got snippets that let you type in HTTP and www and .com faster, but you can browse using just your remote control. And because this is done as a pure Media Center PC app, basically he's hosting IE within this Media Center HTML, and then the resulting composited screen image is remoted over to your Xbox 360.
Right.
You can then surf the net on your Xbox 360. Now, this is not designed for the Xbox 360, but because the Xbox 360 has such rich support for remoting into Media Center, suddenly I can browse on my Xbox, and that's pretty sweet.
That is cool.
Yeah, I guess he's going to be charging soon, but it'll be like $10. And seriously, to browse the web from my 37-inch LCD is going to be awesome, even just to check the news occasionally.
Hey, as long as we're talking about cool things, you know what I just discovered like 4 weeks ago?
What's that?
Slingbox.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah.
Remoting content all over the place.
Slingbox, man. Slingbox.com.
Yeah, with the stuff, whether it be things that Clemens Vasters throws together, like his new television, or a Slingbox, or remoting video around, or using Windows Media Connect. You know, I tell you, if they would just open up the Xbox 360 for video streaming,
yeah,
you could, you know, use the Slingbox with the Xbox 360. There must be some reason they're afraid to open up the Xbox 360's video aspects to the world. I think it's probably some of the, you know, the DRM rights management stuff.
They don't want to sell what is essentially a $1,200 PC for $300. So Slingbox is, for those of you who don't know, Slingbox is one of these things where you can just connect this thing to your cable box and a PC, and then you can log in to your PC and watch the TV and control it.
Yeah, my buddy Greg Hughes blogged about this last September at shrinkster.com/CIJ. Greg Hughes has got a lot of stuff around moving video from place to place and gadgetry and stuff. And I guess they sell this stuff at Radio Shack now, the Slingbox. Yeah. I mean, they've got a good distribution deal.
And slingbox.com is shrinksterized as CII.
Cool. So, yeah, actually, that's a very good kind of segue to talk about some of the problems that I'm having getting my high-definition experience to work out. You know, I have one of these Comcast cable DVRs, digital video recorders. I use the Motorola one.
Yeah, me too. That's the same one I have.
Yeah, and I'm having a heck of a time with this thing. It's just, it stutters. I get phantom chunks of a show, like 10 minutes of a show, and then it'll say it's been interrupted. And I just went from a phase two version to a phase three. If you go up to Wikipedia, you can search for Comcast DVR. There's apparently three versions. I just upgraded by just calling and complaining to the phase three edition, which doesn't include a DVI out. So I couldn't plug it into the DVI on my LCD anymore. So I had to go get a DVI HDMI converter, a little $25 widget, plug it into the cable, and check this out. The Comcast DVR won't output digital audio in the 5.1 Dolby out of the optical if it's plugged into HDMI. Literally, I had the thing plugged and I'm listening to sound. I'm hearing it at 5.1, the big blue light on my receiver is turned on. I plug in the HDMI adapter. It stops and it starts putting out 2-channel Dolby.
Huh.
Pull it back out, pops back to 5.1.
Weird.
For some reason, they stop outputting the 5.1 to the optical, and they start outputting it only from HDMI. Now, who listens to audio out of their HDMI, right? Who uses the little crap speakers on their HDTV?
Right.
So I actually had to downgrade, I felt, just last week. I had to start using the component out of the Comcast, and now I've got slightly degraded video because of the cabling.
Right.
But I've got 5.1. Very frustrating stuff. I've just about had it with these guys. This box is crap, and I'm thinking I want to go somewhere else, but I don't want a satellite hanging off the side of my house, and they don't have decent two-tuner DVRs, do they?
Right, no.
I guess there's a TiVo, DirecTiVo for DirecTV, but it's a couple $100. They gave me the Comcast DVR for free.
I'm unfamiliar with those.
I think it's just a TiVo. It's a high-definition TiVo, but I don't think it has two tuners. And it's TiVo, and TiVo's got that whole kind of like pop, snap, crackle, pop thing with the thumbs up and the thumb down. It's kind of a toy.
Yeah.
I'm just not a fan. But man, until HD works this out where I can just get a standard 2-tuner high-definition DVR, it's not going to happen for me.
Well, you know, you can foresee that you're going to have video cards with HDTV inputs. So, you know, inputs and outputs. So you'll be able to record HDTV with your computer before too long. You got to be able to do it sooner or later.
Well, yeah, you can take like the HDTV All-in-Wonder from ATI. There's a number of inexpensive ones. But I just somehow I don't see my computer deeply involved in my day-to-day HDTV watching. I really want to just plug a cable in from the wall.
Unless you dedicate a computer to that process, which we really have to do, you know.
Right. And then I would need two tuners. Now that I've kind of experienced the two-tuner watching one, you know, watching one show or taping two shows at the same time on
different
channels.
Well, I've actually seen these. I've actually seen, you know, I've seen 8-tuner cards.
Right, except the HDTV cards, for the most part, I believe, pull the HDTV off of the air and not off of the Comcast yet. So we're going to have to wait till the next version of Media Center.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
the next version of Media Center, I guess, supports cable card, so I can get that special card from
the
cable company.
All right, so we talked a little bit about the Ruby language on the show a couple of shows ago. You got some more interesting things to talk about. We're not done.
Yeah, we're not done, and I think we're going to continue to hear more and more about Ruby. Ruby is a really interesting language. One, because I think it's becoming a new second language for .NET folks. You know, the real hardcore comp sci people, computer science people say, you know, always try to learn more and more languages. Don't limit yourself to VB or C#. And they'll say, go learn Lisp or go learn Perl or something like that. But Ruby is a very comfortable, accessible language to people that are familiar with .NET and kind of standard OO practices. But it is still, you know, an interpreted language, and it's a very different world than the .NET world.
Right.
But there's this fella, John Lamb. You may know of him. He's iunknown.com or shrinkster.com/CIG, who is building what he calls the Ruby CLR. And it's really interesting because it's important to note that he's not porting Ruby, the language, in the way that most .NET people are used to hearing about a new language. Hmm. Like, you know about Iron Python, right?
I do.
So it's a compiler that takes Python and makes IL.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you hear Ruby CLR, you kind of think, oh, maybe he's taking Ruby and turning it into IL. What he's doing is he's providing a bridge so that Ruby can call .NET completely transparently. Ruby doesn't just care. It just works.
So it's interop, basically.
Exactly. Exactly. It's Ruby interop, just like Common Interop. It's Ruby interop. And he has actually got a non-trivial Windows Forms 2.0 application, actually a full RSS reader written entirely in Ruby, talking to Windows Forms 2.0, running and up. And when you run this thing, it works, it runs, it looks just fine, it looks like a Windows app, it's fast. But if you look at it in the task manager, it's being run by Ruby.exe.
Wow.
But when you open it up with Process Explorer, you see that .NET's loaded up inside there and he's managing the back and forth.
Wow.
It's pretty crazy. You know, John's a brilliant guy. He's one of these guys who's so brilliant it hurts to talk to him. Because I don't like to feel stupid. But I do, so...
Should try my job someday.
Yeah. He's doing some really neat stuff. He's implementing things like the using pattern with what he calls auto-dispose. He's getting interfaces working. He's got native Ruby array binding.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is something I would use in my everyday life, but when I start thinking about better ways to integrate Ruby testing and some of the water, the REB application testing in Ruby, the water work that we're doing.
Right.
We usually do it where .NET pulls from Ruby. We'll have Ruby write to a file, or we'll listen to Ruby pulling data out at the console, and then we'll just look at that. So it's very poor man's integration. He has got a very kind of first-class integration where .NET objects and Ruby objects are just living together in harmony. And something definitely to watch what he's doing there, even if you don't find yourself using it.
Very cool.
Yeah, totally.
So what was this blog post on view state user key that you did recently?
You know, actually, this was a little while ago, but it keeps coming up. So view state is this pariah, right? I mean, when you think view state, you think this is evil, right?
It's black boxish.
Exactly. It's a big, giant blob of crap that comes by in my hidden form fields. And all you want to do is make it go away and make it smaller.
Right.
And
it still work. Yeah.
Yeah. And no one really knows kind of what it does, or they kind of know that it does, but they know they don't like it.
It's also very dependent on lots of little processes that have to happen.
Exactly. It's very Rube Goldbergian.
Right.
So,
is that a word?
Rube Goldbergian? I think that is a word. You know, Rube Goldberg, right?
Right. He's, sure. You know? The mousetrap game is the expression of Rube Goldberg machines.
Exactly. So, like, yeah. You know, for view state to work, you know, it must be a Tuesday and you must be on one foot, and then the little man will jump off of his ledge right. And into the pool, and then the mouse will get the right. Cheese, and then the view state will come back with an exception. It all works magically. So view state is the state of the view, right? Let's say I had a web page with a single button on it and a single text box, and I typed in foo, and I click on the button.
Yeah,
and then we do what's called a post back, right? We do a form post,
yep.
But we post back to the page that we came from. So it's not only going to send back what's in the text box, it's going to send back what was in the text box when it sent me the page in the first place.
Yeah.
So if I sent you a text box with foo, I erase foo, I type in bar, and then I hit the button, I'm going to send back foo and bar. And yeah. This allows .NET to basically simulate a state when there isn't a state.
Right.
It gives you things like a text changed event.
Right.
So that means duplication. There's a lot of duplicated data.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we want to sometimes turn view state off in certain instances when we don't need it. But there's a number of things that affect view state, particularly what's called the machine key. The machine key is a configuration section in the web.config. And this is kind of a key that is used along with whatever cryptography method that you choose for trying to protect the view state along with your forms authentication ticket.
And it uses some sort of unique identifier to that machine, like a... Network.
Yeah, exactly. It's a big, giant, long number. It's kind of like the MAC address.
MAC address, yeah.
Sort of and there's also a thing called enable view state MAC, which ties the view state in some small way to your MAC address. All of these ways, hoping to detect people doing what I call TiVo attacks, basically yeah. Record and replay attacks.
Yeah.
So there's another kind of little known feature, within ViewState that's called the ViewState User Key. This is a user-specific key, not a machine-specific key. So I could say, if you'd logged in, Carl, via Forms Authentication, I know your name, and I can go and say user.identity.name, and I could put that inside of page.viewstateuserkey. So mm-hmm. then your ViewState is not just married to the machine, so you couldn't record and replay it then, but it's also married to your Forms Auth cookie. And,
yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that a person can't decode and read the ViewState, but it does mean that they can't create their own. It makes ViewState more cryptographically significant. ViewState's not somewhere that you want to put information that's private, but it's definitely a place that you can store information that's not private, but you may need to look at later.
Okay.
So this ViewState user key is really interesting if you're going to be in the middle of automatically enrolling a user into a site. So imagine that you come to a site and the person's anonymous and they're going to be enrolling on the fly. So you're going to learn about them and they're going to type in their name and all their information, their preferred password, and then they're going to enroll on the fly and sign in all at once. This happens a lot in e-banking. We want to be able to join up with a new bank and do it all in an on-the-fly enrollment. So the very first page when I'm anonymous, I'm going to get a view state back that doesn't include anything about my identity.
Right.
Okay. And that view state will be sent and held at the client inside of a hidden form field. But then if I do a post back and enroll them and their identity changes, I might then send them view state that is married to their identity.
Yeah.
Okay. If at some point later on they back up a couple of pages, you know how in most browsers you can back up, and if you go back far enough, it'll say, "Oh, I need to post this data back because the page that we were on."
Bane of my existence, man.
Exactly.
The back button.
Totally sucks, right? And it says, "I need to post this data back." So we're going to go back to an anonymous page, but we are somebody now. We have a Forms Auth cookie.
Yeah.
We are Carl. So then when that page runs, it's going to say, ViewState user key equals who you are. But what's the ViewState that you have saved in your cache?
Right. It's an anonymous.
It's anonymous.
Yeah.
So then your ViewState will invalid. You'll get an invalid ViewState and it's going to kick back. When most people see invalid ViewState exceptions, they usually assume that the machine keys aren't synchronized between two machines. Maybe I got ViewState from machine one and I posted it to machine two. But if you're using, as we do and some folks do, the ViewState user key, you should set that to a known state during that enrollment process. Even if you set it to just like enrollment, some value that is not their name, but maybe is the name of the process.
So what's the long and short of this?
The long and short of this is that if you debug by coincidence, if you know enough to be dangerous, but you don't really understand what's going on, as you move code around, you're going to move your bugs around. This is something that I posted about literally a year ago. I guess this is almost the 1 year anniversary, a year and 3 weeks ago. But it still comes up. It came up in my life. It took me a second to remember what was going on. And this is the nice thing about blogging, of course. You can Google yourself.
Right, right.
Say, you know, I think my brain knew that once. I'm going to go and see if I really did because I blogged about it. But so many people, I think, debug by coincidence, right? This is like, you know, walking into a minefield. And you take three or four steps and you don't die. So that must mean you're not in a minefield.
Yeah, it's empirical.
Exactly. You start pushing stuff around and what's the worst kind of bug, right? It's a flaky.
Right.
And you say, well, you know, I rebooted and darn it, it stopped.
Hmm.
And ViewState's one of those things. But this is the deal. It's not flaky. It's absolutely, completely predictable. ViewState exceptions happen for a reason. It just doesn't feel like they do because it's such a twiddly thing, like you said before. It's such
so many variables involved.
So understanding those things can make you a more kind of effective debugger, and that can be very, very frustrating. And I think that sometimes people need to specialize. They need to become one kind of debugger. Like, I'm really good at debugging HTTP and ASP.NET specific stuff, but you know, I don't think I could do a lot of database debugging. I wouldn't know where to start.
So again, where can you send people if they're having ViewState woes?
So to start with, try decoding the ViewState. You can pull that ViewState out and you can decode it. Go to Google and search for ViewState decoder. There are online decoders that will take apart view state and show you what's inside them. They'll tell you whether or not it was in fact invalid. There are offline ones by Fritz Onion that you can download and keep on your machine to look at view state. Primarily, and if you look at my post at shrinkster.com/CHS, there are only so many things that can go wrong with your view state. Either you have two machines or more, and they do not have their machine keys synchronized. Or you've tried to post some view state to another page.
Right.
Maybe by you've hacked around with the form. Actually, this happened to me last week. A fella needed to do some integration with another vendor. And he was going to post a form using ASP.NET 1.1, not using cross-page postbacks. And he wanted to post his stuff over to this other vendor. The other vendor was also using ASP.NET, and he was consistently getting a view state invalid. So they said, well, gosh, we should just synchronize our machine keys.
Yeah.
Well, but this vendor is going to integrate with other companies. Does that mean that suddenly everyone who wants to use this vendor's integration methodology should use his machine key?
Right.
So how do we fix it? Well, we tried turning off view state, but of course, you know, you can only turn it off so much, and there's always one or two small bits of view state. You can't really turn it off. So we ended up adding a little JavaScript that would actually blow away the view state when this form got submitted. So then no view state was sent over to the other machine.
So you're mucking with it.
Yeah. We were hacking it, but that was the reasonable thing to do other than making this page that was sourcing this form not an ASP.NET form.
Scott, I want to take a minute here to remind the listeners that Hansel Minutes would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsors. And one of those sponsors is Automated QA. They make a great product called Test Complete, which is a testing tool that covers Windows apps, web apps, .NET Framework apps, and Java apps. It's a complete solution, and we'd really like everybody right now to go to automatedqa.com, check out Test Complete, and tell them thanks for supporting Hansel Minutes. You think is there any way to, and I don't know what the answer to this is, but is there any way you can think of to make the whole view state thing work better if you attack the problem at a lower level, perhaps?
Well, that's a very good question. The thing is that the information has to be kind of along with the page. It is the state of the view for that particular page.
It's really the HTTP spec that's the cause of all this problem, right?
You could put all that stuff in a header, right? A cookie wouldn't be appropriate because cookies are not on a per-page basis. They're on a per-domain or a per-virtual directory basis.
And you couldn't just ask the world to change HTTP. I mean, we're talking about a fundamental change to the protocol. Or can you?
Well, I think it's too late. I mean, there will be a new version of HTTP just like there will be a new version of IP, right? IPv6.
Right, but it won't be backward compatible necessarily.
Exactly, and there'll always be layers of schmutz that we just can't do anything about. I mean, HTTP is great. It's stateless. It was meant to push pages around so physicists could look at information.
Exactly.
And it's interesting because years ago, we were all using 3270, right? And for those who don't know 3270, it's basically like bulletin boards. You would log in and you'd get control code sent to the screen, and basically the screen was sent to you. Poor man's X Windows, basically. It was like logging into a bulletin board system.
Basic mainframe kind of.
Right. And that basically remoted the UI, but the client didn't do any work. So then in the 80s and 90s, we switched over to this client server thing where we had VB5 and VB3 and VB6 and, you know, the Dan Appleman years when we had grids and such, and we would transmit only data from the SQL servers.
Hey, I think Dan Appleman would take offense to you saying his years are over.
Oh, no, I don't mean to say his years are over. Dude, I met Dan Appleman at a tech ed, and I took him to lunch, and I just worshiped the ground he walks on.
Maybe the golden years of Dan Appleman.
There you go, the golden years. But I mean, that's like saying it's over for Jerry Lewis,
right?
Jerry Lewis isn't dead, is he?
I don't know. To tell you the truth, I'm embarrassed to say I don't know.
Well, assuming that Jerry Lewis isn't dead.
I don't think so.
Dan Appleman was a legend and will be a legend once again.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we went into this world where we were moving data from place to place. And then we went into HTTP, and folks thought that was a step forward. But it's not. Now we're just pushing user interface around again.
Right.
Except the user interface is angle brackets. And AJAX is kind of the redheaded stepchild of HTTP, where it's like, well, we can't quite get what we want, and we don't quite have a fat client, but we have kind of a chubby client. And, you know, do you really feel that your Pentium 4 is working hard right now?
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's absolutely hanging out. And people hate ASP.NET and Postbacs and Microsoft, for that matter, because they don't understand what the intent was. What would have been a better way to build a state machine to give the VB developers of the day the feeling of eventing? How do you do a text changed event over a stateless protocol?
It seems to be the best implementation you can come up with, other than, as I mentioned before, you know, actually changing HTTP. You know, at attacking, you can either attack it at a lower level, which is more difficult and has its own problems, or you bolt on.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's what we've done. We've bolted on.
Now, that said, there are some hacky and interesting ways that you can make ViewState work for you. David Yak and a number of MVPs, myself included, have got a book coming out that will be available at TechEd called ASP.NET 2.0 MVP Hacks. And this book has a section on screwing around with ViewState, basically a chapter on how to mess with ViewState. And right now, ViewState, of course, comes along with the page, but there's lots of tools and things that you could use to hide the ViewState elsewhere. You can search for this on Google. You can find places where people store ViewState in the session object.
Yeah, I've done that.
Store in the database. You've done that kind of stuff.
Store it to files, yep.
Put in files. That book is available at shrinkster.com/CIK. It'll be also out at TechEd. David Yak will be there. He's just a new RD now, new regional director for Microsoft. Congratulations, David. And just the fact that people have taken the time to hack it and not completely give up on it shows how kind of fundamental to what that it is to the entire framework. It is needed to make eventing work cleanly.
Excellent.
Now, if you abandon the entire eventing model in ASP.NET, sure, you can get away with that view state.
Okay. Hey, switching gears for a minute, what is Fusion?
Ah, Fusion is the thing that resolves assemblies. When you say dynamically load something, if you've ever done like assembly dot load, or if you've for the very first time used a reference and .NET is going to load a library assembly,
yeah.
Fusion is the thing that looks around for that information.
Or even if you have a .NET EXE, when you load the EXE, the first thing that loads up is native code that loads the CLR and all that stuff.
Once the .NET CLR is loaded, once the native code has brought the CLR locally, all references to assemblies are handled by Fusion. And I think if you go into the Windows directory, which I'll do right now, and I'll just go into Windows, and I'll look into Microsoft.NET, and I'll go into the framework directory, and I'll just search for fus/s. So dir fus *s, I see fusion.dll. This DLL gets loaded up into memory and is responsible for all these different resolutions. It resolves libraries.
Is this native or managed?
This is, well, Fusion itself, I don't know. That's a very good question. I know it was largely written by a woman named Suzanne Cook, I believe. But that's as far as I know about its history.
Oh, we'll find out. We'll tell you next week.
Okay. So when you load an assembly, right, you know how the assembly loader works. It looks in the current directory. It looks in the GAC. And there's all these rules around what do you want versus what are you going to get.
Right.
So your application could request version 1, but you could have code in the app.config file that says, No, you're not going to get version 1. You're going to get version 1.1.
Right. Redirection.
Exactly. Binding redirection. You can use publisher policy. Peter Blum uses this very wisely when he releases new versions of his tools, such that he adds them to the GAC and includes publisher policy to indicate that existing applications that were compiled against one version will, in fact, get the new bug-fixed version. And they don't have to recompile.
Right.
Now, the Fusion loader can be very confusing because oftentimes when you're trying to do any kind of dynamic loading, when you're trying to ask the system to give you a DLL and you don't get it, it can be very, very frustrating. It can be very confusing because there's so many things that could go wrong. And there's a really great workshop that Richard Grimes put up at shrinkster.com/CHU. Absolutely phenomenal explanation of how the Fusion system works. And it's step-by-step about the different locations that .NET looks for assemblies, tools that you can use to kind of resolve some of these problems, particularly one that comes with .NET called the Fusion Log Viewer, FUSLogVW. You've got this on your machine already, and you can search for enabling Fusion on Google. And there's just a registry key that you set up. I usually just keep this on all the time. And this is a tool that will automatically dump out log files for all assembly loads that fail on your system.
Wow, this is deep. This is like a book online in HTML
format. This guy is absolutely
format.
Brilliant. And there was a time, a couple of months ago, where he put up a thing at the top saying it was going away. Literally, that it was disappearing, and that I wasn't clear whether Microsoft was shutting him down, and I just went nuts and started emailing people I knew at Microsoft. We got to keep this guy up. So take a look at his stuff. Scroll down to the very bottom, and there's a section on PayPal. This is a book. If it was published as a book, you'd pay $50 for it. And this is the kind of thing that you'd take a 2-week seminar on.
Right.
The amount of effort this guy has put into this is unreal. I have not found anywhere, even in Don Box's books or Jeffrey Richter's books, a better explanation of how Fusion works than this place. So,
well, he's got my $50.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. I wish there was a way to download it, but if people did, they would go and they'd steal it. He's even got it completely updated for version 2 of .NET, and it explains exactly how Fusion works. Now, Fusion's one of those things where if you don't have a problem with it, thank yourself, because we always say that .NET hides DLL hell, but there's another hell. It's called assembly hell.
Yep.
Right? .NET doesn't hide DLL hell. It takes it off the backs of the user and puts it on the back of the developer. Being an effective debugger within .NET means understanding Fusion if you're doing any kind of dynamic binding of stuff, which actually gets me into another thing about really dynamic things that happen within .NET, which is like debugging XML serializers. If you used the XML serializer before, right?
Sure.
Works absolutely phenomenally until it completely doesn't work at all.
Right.
And there's
another one of those black box things.
It is. Because what's it doing? It's looking at your object, gleaning how it's going to serialize it, taking a good guess and getting it right 99% of the time until it gets entirely wrong. A really, really interesting thing to try is debugging into an XML serializer. Because when you say XML serializer equals new XML serializer, x.serialize, a lot of stuff happens. Basically, a miracle happens, and then a whole pile of code gets generated. They reflect over your object, and they generate code. You can see that code by making in your app config file, right, your application.exe.config, adding a diagnostic switch called XML serialization.compilation and setting its value to some value that's not zero. I've got this up on my blog. This is an older post at shrinkster.com/chx. You really got to try this. I encourage you to try this first. You set this up. You run your application. I have a very trivial example already done for you. You compile and you run and you step up in the debugger right up to the line where the serializer is constructed.
Yeah.
Step over the line where they make the serializer and then go poking around in documents and settings. Hmm. Deep in the bowels under local settings temp, you're going to see a bunch of created .cs files, even if you're using VB.
Hmm.
Open up that file and you're going to see Microsoft.xml.serialization.generatedAssembly in a new namespace, and you're going to see a whole pile of code generated specific to your object. Now, here's the cool part. If you set a breakpoint in that generated file, the PDBs are in there too, right? The programmable debug databases
right.
are in there.
So
you can then serialize
it.
And then debug into the serializer. And when the serializer is not
That's
working,
cool.
And this is another thing. The XML serializer is a thing that other people get very frustrated with. They get angry with it, just like they do with ViewState. But you can see what's going on. I've been fighting with the serializer for 2 years. We use it a lot at Carillion, and we struggle with it. If I couldn't debug into it, I'd be very frustrated. But the fact that I can go in and say, oh, I see what the serializer is getting wrong, and then I can come up with ways to give it what it wants. It's not perfect, but it's not a black box. It's kind of a gray box.
Wow. That's incredible. You know, I can always count on you to find visibility tools, tools that help you see into those black boxes. And
I like that. That's really Hanselman's visibility tools. That's
well,
that
it's
is
true.
What,
I mean, you introduced me to FileMon, basically, which is the file monitor. If people don't know what that is. Anytime you an application hangs, I was just using this, right?
Mm-hmm.
An application hangs, you don't know why. It's accessing the disk. You want to see what it's doing. So
it's doing something. Lights are flashing. It must be doing something.
You run FileMon, and it basically is like a tracer for all file activity, and it tells you what apps are loading what files, mm-hmm. and that way you can sort of see what it's doing.
Yeah. Regmon does the same thing for the registry.
Yeah.
I was struggling with some stuff with a stupid little shareware application. I just could not figure out what they must have been looking for something, and they couldn't find it, and they would freak out, and I got to find out the keys they were poking around looking for. And this is the thing. From being a good I call it being a good .NET citizen. I've got a blog about this at shrinkster.com/CHV. Your debugging skills really are about you understanding what's happening, because we all know that .NET is managed spackle. Right. It's spackling over all of the garbage in Win32. Win32 was not fun, and .NET hides that from us. But somebody's got to call load library.
Yeah.
When you say, you know, dimx as new object, somebody's got to call load library. And forgetting that that's the case is a mistake I think a lot of people make. Now, you don't necessarily all have to be a plumber, and you don't have to know how to do that stuff. I know that somebody's got to call move ax, comma, you know, cx. In the assembler, that's a little farther down than I want to go. I'll find someone. But it is happening. So when people say, oh, man, it worked yesterday and it didn't work today, there is a reason.
Yeah, you just got to go down a couple levels.
Yeah, exactly. And reformatting or paving your machine, even though I did it last month, when you don't know what's wrong, you know, if you get a spot in your carpet, you fix the spot, you don't lay new carpet.
Right.
So it's a pretty decent analogy. So if you really understand your environment, you can understand what your program's dependencies are, you know?
Yeah.
And debug.assert is something I don't think enough people use.
Yeah, that's a good point. Debug.assert to actually stop the program and say, hey, programmer, you got a problem here.
Right. Some people will try to write overly defensive code, and they'll have all sorts of if this is null, if that is null. But they don't ever have anything. They don't ever say what they're going to do about it.
Yeah.
They'll just say, oh, crap, this is null. What are you going to do? Well, you continue running and you freak out. But if you get into a situation where something's null and there's no chance in hell that your system should be returning null at that point.
Yeah.
Express that.
Yep.
Express that in the code. And don't express that in the code by popping up a message box.
Yeah.
Assert. You know, if your system has, you know, three states that it could be in and one of the states is completely invalid, assert that. Express that. Anything that your system should not be doing, you need to express. And debug.assert is a really great way to do that.
All right, let's move on to YAT, Y-A-T-T.
What is Vasislos? So everything at pocketsoap.com is brilliant. This is Simon Fell, and YAT is yet another trace tool. You probably use trace tools like Ethereal. There's lots of tools,
sure.
The Windows Network Monitor. But this is kind of like Regmon or FileMon for the network.
Okay.
YAT is yet another trace tool. He's also got a number of other tools out there like ProxyTrace and TCPTrace. And these are tools that let you see the traffic that are going to and from your system. I like YAT because it's nice and simple. It's very basic GUI. It shows to and fro. And you can say, only show me things on this network card going to that host.
Hmm.
So recently when I was building a baby webcam so I could see Zenzo from work, I wanted to debug into this inexpensive camera that I bought at Fry's Electronics. I'm going to be writing an article about this soon. And I just fired up YAT. And what I thought was going to be a video stream from this cheapo webcam, in fact, turned out to be an HTTP stream that would never end, that just went JPEG, 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 JPEG.
Huh.
It's called MJPEG. It's not MPEG, it's MJPEG, which is basically, I'll throw you JPEGs as fast as you can draw them.
Sort of a brute force method of video there.
Well, brute force, but this is the thing. I was thinking, why are they doing this? If they had to do a video codec, like a compressor decompressor, they'd have to pay somebody.
Yeah.
But I bet you it's free to throw JPEGs around.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally does.
Yeah, so this is what I mean by visibility tools, you know, knowing what's going on under the hood. Helps you solve the problem faster.
Totally, totally. Recently, a guy came to me here at Carillion with a really weird problem. I love it when people come to me with weird problems. And he had installed a web service on his machine. Everything has worked fine on 6 different machines, but on this machine, it wasn't happening. He decided to browse to the ASMX file, and he got 404. And he looked in the directory, and the files were there, and he looked in IIS, and the files were there, and it just wasn't happening. So it's like, well, who's returning the 404? We kind of asked ourselves. It's probably IIS, probably not ASP.NET, that was saying 404 because we knew the file was there. And it wasn't a 500. It wasn't saying the DLL is not compiling or the code's boogered. It said 404.
Not found.
Not found. Something's not found, right? So there's your first tip, right? And this is the thing when people have problems like this is to say, is the error message I'm giving me providing me value? Is the error message I'm being given providing me value? Yeah. 404 is saying, I'm not finding something. So then understanding how ASP.NET plugs into IIS was a first step. So we went into the IIS manager, we right-clicked on the folder, we hit properties, and went to configuration, and noticed that the ASMX extension was not mapped. So IIS didn't know how to handle ASMX. This is a real common thing if you install IIS after you install ASP.NET. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we go out and we type in ASP.NET regiis-i, installs ASP.NET. So then I'm thinking, oh, well, I've done this 10 times before. I'm done, right?
Yeah.
You're thinking the same thing.
I am.
We visit it, 404.
So the next thing I would do is check the version.
Okay. So we go in and we check the version. It's version 1.1. Mm-hmm. That's the right version. We don't have 2.0 on this machine.
Okay.
That's cool. They're mapped. The extensions are mapped correctly. 404. Then I'm thinking, well, and this is where I wasn't thinking clearly, maybe the ASP.NET user has no access. So I start assigning access to the ASP.NET user, in this case, network service, because it was Windows 2003.
Okay.
So then I'm thinking, wait a second. That would have been a 403. That would have been a forbidden.
Right. That's right.
And then I said, well, wait a second. I didn't just assign access to the ASP.NET user, because that would be on Windows XP Pro. I assigned access to the network service user. Then I was reminded I'm on a Windows 2003 machine, and what does 2003 do with ASP.NET?
Yeah, there's another account for that, isn't there?
Yeah, it's the network service
network
account.
Network, right.
But it was that Windows 2003 disables ASP.NET by default.
Oh, sure.
Under their extension stuff in IIS by
They disable
for
everything by default.
Exactly.
ASP and ASP.NET.
They lock it down. So I had to go into the extensions and explicitly allow it. Then it worked. So there were actually two things wrong, and they were kind of hiding each other. But you had to kind of do the root cause to figure this out. And it's funny how one will find themselves, twiddle a bit, hit F5, twiddle a bit, put F5.
Sure.
It's, expecting a different result each time. And I did it in this case as well.
It's an old story that I've told many times, but, we used to be surgeons back in the days of DOS and single process stuff where we didn't have multitasking going on. You write some code, you have control of the machine until you release it, And now increasingly, with Windows and multi-threading and all this stuff, you're more like a psychologist. You spend some time with the computer, you have a conversation, you make some suggestions, you observe the behavior, you prescribe some meds, you come back, you're right, it's an empirical kind of thing.
It feels like, I used to say CSI, .NET. It's putting all the clues together and say, you're trying to tell me something, it's like cold case.
Yeah, okay. And on that note, we have a show. It's been a little bit of a long one, but we think the listeners will appreciate it. And Scott, have a great week, and we'll talk to the listeners next week on Hanselman.